This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. There's more at allbook-books.com. And check out the Substack for the most recent poems and essays, musings from Between the Lines. So a while ago, I did an episode about Jesus based on Harold Bloom's book, Jesus and Yahweh, the Names Divine. And this is on the Yahweh half of the book. And I'll preface it because it ties in with the subject that I felt kind of like prompted or guided, as if I needed to just like, you got to read this now, that kind of feeling that made me start to read it. And from whence that comes, I don't know, but it ties in with the mystical path of the Kabbalah, which means personally received teaching. So while I can't pinpoint where that was coming from, I attribute it to some kind of spiritual energy that was prompting me. And I mention this because Yahweh is a aspect of God with the Kabbalah's tree of life. So while people are often arguing over the quote one God, I find that both sad and amusing from the Kabbalah perspective, because just like everything is all one in a sort of physical, metaphysical sense, that's beyond any person or projecting a human onto God. It's just all one energy. Yet there are what's called 10 God aspects, which is sort of like flavors and functions of God or of spirit, and Yahweh is one of them. And Yahweh is basically one's personal connection, communication with the male father energy. And that's one significant gist. It's like with all the different aspects of God that may be impersonal or just, they're doing their thing, but that aspect of God is like, hey, I'm gonna talk to you personally now. So I received, as part of my path, I received a personal image of what Yahweh is to me. But I'm not going to say that because, it's too personal. And for two, people would probably think I'm nuts, because it's like it defies all the sort of literary this and that of Yahweh and whoever else one is talking about. So that's part of what I think what got me to want to read is a sense of seeing how Yahweh's interpreted and what the world thinks of Yahweh. In general, Bloom does touch on that human connection part very briefly. That inner spark. It's like that inner spark of Yahweh. But in general, I just find it's just absurd how, from what I know through the Kabbalah, this personal connection with one aspect of God the Father, there are other male aspects that became somehow some kind of biblical, this vengeful, violent, and all kinds of crazy stuff to me. It's just crazy stuff. So, but that's some of what Bloom explores as a literary critic. So there are some paragraphs I read where it just, I understood the words, but it all went right over my head because he's making umpteen literary references. So it was great to read it, to just kind of be aware and stimulate my understanding and where the world is at. As he says with in the Jesus section begins, that there are no known verifiable facts about Jesus. Later in the chapter, he does name a couple of things, so he kind of contradicts himself. But even if there's just a few verifiable facts, I just found that illuminating, astounding, And, quote, heretical, because what is it, like a billion or more, or whatever it is, a huge amount of people in the whole planet has been, Christmas, on the celebratory side, the doctrine of Christian discovery and domination on the dehumanization and domination side, and all based on, according to Bloom, someone who there's nothing really much known about. So similarly with Yahweh, like what is known about him, and Bloom makes lots of references to different people's interpretations and opinions, and a lot of them are literary. So I found that difficult, but amidst that, a lot of interesting stuff. A few of the identities that he refers to of Yahweh is like the Father, YHWH. God, like God himself, him, her, whatever self, the unknowable. So he gets into like how much he is in the world and not in the world. He mentions Yahweh being both present and absent. So there's a lot of different ways, and I don't know what the I'm not going to try to be scholarly and say there's a particular answer or anything. I'm just sharing what my sense of what the this half of the book discussed. And he presents the YHWH in the beginning as God's proper name in the Hebrew Bible. How the name was pronounced, we will never know. Yahweh is merely surmised because oral tradition guarded the sacred flames and sacred name. Well, this is one of the reasons why, reading books, people read a book and then they think they know everything. But my personal learning and experience is that, yes, there is a way to pronounce that name. So, yeah, whatever. Some of the bits that stood out to me in this chapters. And Bloom defines himself as a literary critic divided between Judaic heritage and a Gnostic discomfort with God. So that's what flavors some of the book. It always helps to know what flavors. And again, I would disagree. Nothing in the career of Jesus suggests a role as divine warrior. Another esoteric understanding I learned from a friend is that, yes, he is here. Jesus and Christ, to essence, is like he's here to cut through the bullshit. So anyway, so many interpretations, which again defies the sense of a lot of the sense of religion, as if it is written not in stone but in the books. I actually met a really friendly young couple while having coffee the other day, and they were really positive, upbeat energy, and then somehow it got into meditation talk, and they mentioned being like, they mentioned Jesus and this and that, and then so when it got to but we're made in his image, I was talking about the nature and the trees and this and that, and they were like, we're made in his image, that's what the book says. And I'm like, but what image? And how do you know what image? And I said, and they said, well, trees don't talk. And I said, yeah, they do. I said, they talk to me, so whatever. But it's the vantage point that one starts with that then presumes sort of where everything else follows. So their presumption of, as much as well-intended, their presumption is that, we're the ones that made in the image, but, what image was the tree made in? I did like that they said that, because much of what I've learned of Christianity is, it's like the reward is in heaven, but their understanding of Jesus is that, his energy is present right here and now. So I did actually learn something I did like about that, but anyway, that's a side topic. Some other highlight. Some fascinating bits. Northern and Eastern gods can be tricksters, and perhaps all divinities, Yahweh included, ultimately had shamanistic origins, now frequently beyond trace. Another paradox is that Yahweh alternates between impish mischief and moral terror. So this is where I questioned, what Yahweh, like, it's like going by what's been written about Yahweh then becomes the definition that, he goes between impish mischief and moral terror. So whose experiences of that? See, that's where this stuff flies in the face of what I know as it's within it, the Yahweh is an entity unto itself, but it is in within each of us. So that's where, you know, that's where my strong feeling is that religion misses the boat. No, joke intended, because it in many ways disempowers. Now some Christians may argue that, but they found the Christ within, so that's good and well, but in general I find that it disempowers in my reading of the stuff. Here's one I found extremely ironic and quite humorous in its way, that Jesus was unmarried. I mean, this is already known, but he's married to God, to Spirit, but Jesus unmarried, and yet what is the single most promoted thing of Christianity, Catholicism, is the family. It's like, I don't know, now that I think about it, it's like they hijacked, because, you know, the child then becomes the Jesus child. That I think it seems like the product of the family becomes like the Christianity Jesus Christ part. But, you know, like, just now they're starting to be okay about gays and lesbians and stuff, but, you know, who knows? Jesus was unmarried, so, like, why the fixation on the family? Bloom writes, Jesus did not marry, a scandal in his tradition. The mass appeal worldwide of Christianity of its rival Islam is founded upon simplicity of interpretation. Christianity's triumph over Judaism in the early centuries of the Common Era could not have come about on a theological basis. Believe that Jesus was the Christ and you will be saved and live eternally proved irresistible on the popular level. Later, this was matched by submit to Allah on the authority of Muhammad, seal of the prophets, and you will be rewarded in the life to come. The survival of Yahwism could be for a remnant only. It was not any supposed distinction between law and love that isolated Judaism, but an ongoing historical trauma. I'm not even sure what that means, but I'm not going to worry about it. If you argue that Jesus has saved countless others, it remains clear that himself he could not save. Yet another irony. So to me, a lot of the stuff is the hook of hooks, the fear of spirit, instead of learning how to relate to spirit. That's what I've thought for a long time and written about, that the what is promoted is that the spirit is outside of oneself, and there's a lot of fear in it. If you don't submit, if you don't believe, it creates a fear of spirit. I think that's one of the biggest problems in the world, that people grow up with a fear of spirit rather than kindly, gently learning to nourish it, which is part of my appreciation for the indigenous communities, that they don't have that fear of spirit. They welcome it from an early age. So here's where some of the explanations, just to give you an example of where it gets a bit much to my reading taste. And some of the Kabbalah mentioned in this book is based on the books, like the well-known books of the Zohar and Lurianic Kabbalah. And those are things that I have only read the smidgens of. Creation, according to the sages, has the simple object of the human. Yahweh had no other purpose, and Yahweh was monistic in his approach. Hebrew man does not divide into flesh against spirit, but is a living soul. Pauline dualism, which eventually ensues in the Cartesian separation of mind and body, is Platonic and not Judaic. Presumably, the Christian God the Father does not, like Yahweh, have a body, except in Mormonism. So anyway, on and on it goes. I do like the phrase Aristotle's unmoved mover. I think I used that in a poem once, unmoved mover. Here's one that I found a good point. Christians revere the birth of Jesus the Christ child and the descent of the Holy Spirit, but no theologian wonders about the origin of the Holy Father. That's one, you know, where, like, you asking questions, you know, well, people just accept, just speaking in general, people just accept things, you know, the way people just accept sometimes what the corporate media says, and it's like, oh, well, the Holy Father, that's the Holy Father. But where does that come from? Who came up with that image? Why is it even called Father? Why is it holy? I mean, these are questions that can and need to be asked, either, you know, in with oneself or whoever. Here was one of my questions here that I came up. How can a supreme God have chosen people? That's my religious Zen koan. How can a supreme God have chosen people? And he does a few times. I found quite fascinating his mention of the American Jesus. And here's where he does mention the something like the spark or pneuma of the Gnostic survives in the Neshama, Yahweh within us. So that touches you specifically on what I know personally, and other people I know of Yahweh with the Tree of Life. That the spark of the divine. It's like we each have a spark of the, you know, in that sense, that we each have something that is our spark connection, spark relationship with the divine. And Yahweh helps with that. And I'll read this section toward the end of the book. And there was a phrase I didn't know of. It mentions a particular power of Christian Kabbalah. I did not really know that. So that's something for me to look up. And he also talks about the distance. Like people tend to lump together Judeo-Christian because of some of the origins. But he talks about how they are, there's like very different towards the end of the book. He mentions that, but here's an interesting, I found this extremely interesting. One step further on, and you come to our American moment, where God the Father has faded away, yielding both to the American Jesus and to his increasingly strong rival, the Holy Spirit of our Pentecostalism, which richly mixes Hispanics, African Americans, and dispossessed urban and southern whites. So there's more there than I know about, and but yeah, I find that interesting how it's like the Jesus gets the attention, you know, compared to God the Father. The American Jesus may become too compromised by the Christian right to go on as the intimate friend of the dispossessed. The American Jesus may become too compromised by the Christian right to go on as the intimate friend of the dispossessed. So that's more of my personal knowing of Jesus, which I have found through the Kabbalah. So in that sense, hey, I do already understand Christian Kabbalah in that sense, but I don't label these things much. But that to me is the intimate friend of the dispossessed. The places where I do not fit into here and there, the Christ energy is my friend, but not aligned with the all the various stuff of the Christian right. And Chris Hedges has written about the fascist Christian, you know, severe right wing, this and that. There's another angle on all that. And here's a fascinating bit towards the end. Yeah, here's something I found that part of perhaps explains some of my affinity for the native peoples. The desperate needs of a Jewish people occupied and terrorized by the Roman Empire, because that was certainly the Roman Empire has certainly been a terror to many people, and continues with the doctrine of Christian discovery and dehumanization. But here's something I learned. The temple had been destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE and most of Jerusalem with it. In 135 CE, after the Roman Holocaust that followed the massive Bar Kokhba rebellion, Israel's last stand before 1947, Jerusalem was obliterated. And Akiba was martyred at the age of 95 by the abominable Hadrian, who massacred more Jews than anyone else in history before Hitler. Christianity had replaced the temple by the person of Jesus Christ. While Akiba rebuilt the temple in every Jewish household, Yahweh, who still feels homeless after his temple's destruction, seems to me to have exiled himself somewhere in the outer spaces until he returned to Israel in 1948. In the year 2004, when I write, one can only hope that he does not demand his temple again, since Al-Aqsa Mosque stands upon its site, and we have quite enough religious war already without what could prove to be that final catastrophe. Zealots in Jerusalem and scattered throughout American Protestant fundamentalism conspire incessantly to destroy the inconvenient mosque, and suitably pure red heifers are being bred in the United States as potential sacrifices to lure Yahweh back to his temple grounds. I think that's the sign. The red heifer, when a red heifer is seen, is the sign of the temple. Which is interesting too, because the Lakota speak of the white buffalo calf woman, and in the 1994, I think, was the first sighting of the white buffalo calf. Anyway, things go on different tangents, and the book ends with another interesting. This is because Greek theological formulations and Hebraic experimental memories simply are antithetical to each other. Well, I could relate to that, the experience being over the conceptual. That's one of the brunts of my book, Moving Through the Empty Gay Forest, is encouraging experiences over the written and the concepts and the book. And another thing I found interesting towards the end, Bloom, his sense, this is again, where one's perspective about God or spirit is. Deploring religion is as useless as celebrating it. Where shall transcendence be found? So that, to me, he talks about transcendence. So that to me, is reflective of the religions in the Judeo-Christianity and the Islam, which are in many ways contradictory to the indigenous peoples, because there isn't a need to transcend. Rather, the responsibility to care for the earth and all the beings here. So that's a huge gap between, religions and what I would call sort of indigenous aboriginal spirituality. And the personal experiences that I know through the Kabbalah. So, I'm not going to recommend or not recommend this book. It's fascinating on many levels. It's challenging. It's, it's got bits here and there that I find just really helped me to get a sense about what masses of people go on. And it's for those who are open-minded and want to discuss, it's fascinating. For those who are already programmed to go by what the book says, then that becomes a challenging discussion, as was my case with the very friendly couple that I met having coffee this week. It was interesting, but it would have got way challenging to go at it. So that's it for the book review and thoughts about Harold Bloom's Jesus and Yahweh, The Names Divine, published by Riverhead Books, 2005. The way I would recommend it is if you want to get a wider perspective about the people, the archetypes, whatever you call them, that has such an influence on huge amount of people in the world, then I would say read it. But it's a challenging read, and like I said, I just went past a lot of places that were sort of way too literary, intellectual for my taste. But I thank Harold Bloom for daring to go at it at those topics, because he bandied about from many, many different angles, and that's refreshing. And to wrap it up, I'll add that this from William G. Gray's The Ladder of Lights, which is another way of saying the Kabbalah Tree of Life, that the God aspect, IHVH, Sabaoth, Yahweh Sabaoth, is usually translated Lord God of Hosts, but here it signifies the male, positive, divine element of every living soul. Just as at Hod is another aspect of God, we found the female seeking male potency, so at Netzach we have the male seeks female principle. So this is the that the male and female are within each of us, yet also many as I see it, many male female couples are manifestations of that male and female potential, but some people who forego that path look to the male, blending the male and female within. Gray also writes, Yahweh Sabaoth is the male God type of every life form, be it human or otherwise, and is the extremity of masculinity that can exist for any living being. And to that, on the personal side, I'll add that my experience of knowing some Christians and having Christian friends, and in general, many people have their own personal, you know, relationship with Jesus or Christ or whatever, and that's well and good. That's theirs. That's the, each's personal relationship that is different than the institutionalized religion of Christianity or Catholicism in its many branches and forms, which I don't know much about. As one example, a good friend is Christian. Once in a while, he wears his little necklace with the cross, and but you know he doesn't really ever talk much about it. We talk about lots of different stuff, and so I have, you know, deep respect that he doesn't you know proselytize at all or even talk about it much at all. And so, you know, some topics we just don't go there, but we don't need to, because he has his way that works for him. I have my way. Yahweh is part of my way. And, you know, and that's well and good. And I think that's a way for people to get along, is to respect whatever person's personal experience is. And, you know, that's not something to argue about. So that's one way to have a more peaceful world and existence, and all get along here with the Mother Earth and all the different forms and the spirit beings and the earth beings and all that good stuff. So thanks for listening, and may you find the spirit within you, and may the spirit find the you within you, however that goes. Thanks for listening. Be well.